Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Chantel having a two-drink minimum at her kitchen table. Today is Thursday, April 12th, 2018, and the time is 5:30 in the p.m. I am having a glass of red wine, and I am also drinking a lot of water. And the reason for that is I am going to be tackling a big topic today, one that I've been saying that I want to cover for quite some time, and I think today is the time to cover it with everything that is in the headlines. So, we are going to talk Syria. And I know it is a big topic. I am going to break it down in very easy to digest. You know what? I'm going to break it down in a way that will be understandable. Easy to digest? Probably not. Understandable? I really think so. And then we're going to go, I'm going to discuss the petrodollar, and then I'm also going to talk all of the headlines about Syria. I'm not going to do very much drinking during this episode. One, because this is a tougher topic to cover, and I want to make sure that I speak clearly and plainly and all that stuff. Also, because I lost a prior episode, it got lost into the oblivion of technology. I feel like I'm kind of behind on podcasts, and so I'm hoping to get at least two in tonight. So I need to keep my wits about me. And let's be honest, I don't always have my wits about me on some of these podcasts by the time I'm done with them. So I will do a quick cheers. And let's get started. Okay, so when it comes to Syria, most people think it started in 2011 with the Arab Spring. I would have been one of those people had I not, well, no, actually, I was one of those people. I was one of those people that thought all of this started in 2011 with the Arab Spring, up until a couple years ago. So, it actually started in 2000 when Qatar proposed building a natural gas pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. Iran and Saudi Arabia have the largest natural gas deposits in the world. So I'm going to repeat that. I will also do a lot of repeating of things because I know for me, when you throw a lot of heavy facts and a lot of different countries, it gets super confusing really fast, no matter how you break it down. So don't worry, you're not going to have to rewind. I will repeat some things. So, in 2000, Qatar proposed building a natural gas pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey due to the fact that Iran and Saudi Arabia have the largest natural gas deposits in the world. So, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Turkey, they were all on board with this. They were like, yep, let's do this. However, there was a second pipeline being proposed by Iran, which would have gone through Iraq and Syria. So Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Turkey were on board with Qatar building a gas pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. But a second pipeline was proposed by Iran, and that pipeline would have gone through Iraq and Syria. That is what this is all about. Two other really important things is that Qatar is Sunni and Iran is Shia. So again, Qatar, Sunni, Iran, Shia. So Russia is against the Qatar pipeline. So the first one that was being proposed back in 2000, Russia doesn't want that pipeline. Because Russia sells 70% of their gas exports to Europe, and the Qatar-Turkey pipeline would be a threat. So that is why Russia does not want the Qatar pipeline going through Turkey, because it would be a threat to Russia's ability to export oil to or to Europe, rather. So Putin views the Qatar pipeline as a NATO plot to change the status quo and to deprive Russia of its foothold in the Middle East, which would hurt the Russian economy and end their leverage in the European energy market. So all of this is, just like everything else, is going to come down to oil and who controls the oil and who control only this is natural gas. That's what this is all about. So again, Putin would view the Qatar pipeline as a NATO plot to change the status quo and to deprive Russia of its foothold in the Middle East and to take away its ability to export the oil, gas to Europe. So the CIA, since the 1950s, they've been trying to obviously assert themselves in other people's governments. This is no secret. And has caused the anti-American sentiment that is being felt all around the world. So the Middle East views on America, it's not that they hate our freedoms and it's not that they hate our capitalist ideas. It's because we, the U.S., the United States, we keep fucking with them and we keep fucking with their freedoms and we keep bombing the crap out of them and we keep killing millions and millions of civilians in the name of war and, casualties. And it's over a fucking resource. It's over oil. When we could go to solar, we could go to wind, we could go to wave and water energy. There's a lot of other things we could be doing. So anything that you hear in terms of like, well, the Middle East, they're just, they hate our freedoms. They hate our capitalist society. No, but no, that's not it. In the U.S., obviously, due to all of the wars that we're currently in, we want the oil in the Middle East. So anytime there's going to be an uprising where the people of the Middle East start to fight back, we, the U.S., go in our allies. We go in and we cause a disturbance and we cause a war. We infiltrate, basically, and we cause, quote, an uprising. So in 2009, Assad in Syria, Assad is the president, dictator, leader, whatever word you want to use, of Syria. He refused to sign the agreement to allow the pipeline to run through Syria because he wanted to, quote, protect the interests of our Russian ally, end quote, which is when the military and intelligence people decided to formulate a Sunni uprising in Syria. So again, Qatar is Sunni. They decided to formulate a Sunni uprising in Syria. Prior to that, Assad was looking to liberate Syria and to move his country more towards the West and was moving in that direction prior to 2009. And then also important, after 9/11, Assad gave the CIA invaluable files on jihadists who he considered to be a mutual enemy. So he helped us after 9/11, when we then went into all those countries that weren't part of 9/11, again, because of oil. So I'm just going to make this really, 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 really simple. The reason we are in all of these countries that you may or may not know that we are in all of those countries because of oil. It is, if there's something shitty going on in a country, and we, the police of the world, the United States, are not going in there to do anything about it, it's because they don't have a resource that we give a fuck about. So if they happen to have a resource that we care about, which usually ends up being oil or gas, then we're gonna come in and we're gonna cause some sort of disturbance and somehow take over the country. Slowly, surely, that's what we're going to do. Okay, so back to Syria. So on September 4th, 2016, Secretary of State at the time, John Kerry, told a congressional hearing. So this was a congressional hearing that John Kerry gave on September 4th, 2016, that the Sunni kingdoms had offered to foot the bill for a U.S. invasion of Syria to oust Assad. Quote, this is now a quote from John Kerry. In fact, some of them have, and he's referring to Qatar and Saudi Arabia, said that if the U.S. is prepared to go do the whole thing the way we've done it previously in other places, and he was referring to Iraq and Afghanistan, they'll carry the cost, end quote. Kerry then reiterated, quote, with respect to Arab countries offering to bear the cost of an American invasion to topple Assad, the answer is profoundly yes, they have. The offer is on the table. Did you get that? If not, I'm now going to repeat it. To Congress, he said, Sunni kingdoms have offered to foot the bill for a U.S. invasion of Syria to oust Assad. Quote, in fact, some of them have said that if the U.S. is prepared to go do the whole thing the way we've done it previously in other places, they'll carry the cost, meaning Qatar and Saudi Arabia. He then reiterated, with respect to Arab countries offering to bear the cost of an American invasion to topple Assad, the answer is profoundly yes, they have. The offer is on the table. We fund both sides, and Saudi Arabia and Qatar are paying us to cause major upheaval to innocent people, kill innocent people, destroy countries, destroy lives in the name of oil, and to topple someone that decided to have the resources of oil and gas go to his people instead of to the United States. And do you see how we react to things like that? If you don't say yes to us, see how we react? So then in 2011, the U.S. joined France, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and England to form the, it was called the Friends of Syria Coalition, which formally demanded the removal of Assad. So this was in 2011, where the U.S. joined France, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and England to demand the removal of Assad. The CIA then provided $6 million to BRADA, B-R-A-D-A, which is a British TV channel, to produce pieces supporting an Assad removal, also known as propaganda. I'm going to take a quick drink. So that was in 2011. So when the Arab Spring in 2011, and then we start the propaganda machine, joined by France, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and England, quote, Friends of Syria Coalition. In 2012, Saudi intelligence documents published by WikiLeaks show that Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia were arming, training, and funding radical jihadist Sunni fighters from Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere to overthrow the Assad Shia-aligned regime. Don't worry, I'm going to repeat that. Intelligence from Saudi Arabia, which was published by WikiLeaks in 2012, show that Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia were arming, training, and funding radical jihadist Sunni fighters from Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere to overthrow the Assad Shia-aligned regime. The idea of forming a Sunni-Shia civil war to weaken the Syria and Iranian regimes so as to maintain control of the region's petrochemical supplies wasn't a novel notion to the Pentagon's lexicon. It wasn't the first time that it had been considered, in other words. So in 2008, a Pentagon-funded RAND report proposed a precise blueprint for what was about to happen. The report observed that the control of the Persian Gulf and the oil there and the gas deposits will remain for the U.S. a strategic priority, and that is a quote. And that quote will interact strongly with that of prosecuting the long war, end quote. And the long war was to overthrow Assad, who was being uncooperative. And again, what made him uncooperative is that he wanted the gas and oil reserves to stay in his country and the money from those things to be given to his people. And we said, no, that's not how this works. And we will show you how this works. And so we are going to go in and destroy your country, and we are going to disseminate propaganda, and we are going to smear you in your name because we want your gas and oil reserves. So all of this is to finish the Qatar-Turkey gas pipeline. And the reason why Russia is involved and we're poking the Russia bear is because Russia wants a different pipeline. And to go back to the 70s, the reason we overthrew Iran at that time was because they wanted to keep the oil and profits for their people. And we said no, and so we overthrew the Ayatollah. So this goes back to the 50s, and it goes back to the 50s in the Middle East and trying to overthrow all these countries for 50 years, or actually 70 years at this point. I'm just going to call it 70, rounding up just a tad little bit, because of oil and gas deposits. So unfortunately, Saudi Arabia has a lot of oil and gas deposits. So sorry, people, you're fucked. All of that oil and riches that you and freedoms that you had in the 50s and 60s. Yeah, well, we got to do something about that. Okay, so I'm going to go back to the very beginning, and I'm just going to reiterate a few points. Because even though I know all this, I truly think it's just confusing. And I think it's unnecessarily confusing, and I think it's really easy to get confused. Okay, so all of this goes back to 2000 when Qatar proposed building a natural gas pipeline through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. Qatar, tiny, 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 tiny little country, wanted a natural gas pipeline to go through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Turkey were all on board. But second pipeline was being proposed by Iran to go through Iraq and Syria. So Russia is against the Qatar pipeline, the one that would go through the most countries, because Russia sells 70% of their gas exports to Europe, and the Qatar-Turkey pipeline would be a threat. So, poking the Russian bear, Russia, the reason Russia is involved in Syria is because of this pipeline. And the reason why we've decided Assad is bad, which I think he got into power in 2001. I'm pretty certain of that, but I'm going to double check it just to make sure. And I have about a billion links up for the next topic I'm going to go into. So Assad. Not that this has anything to do with anything, but Assad's wife is gorgeous. Okay, so, oh no, I was wrong. Okay, I was wrong. He assumed office on July 17th, 2000. And unfortunately, in all the pictures of him, I think it kind of looks like he doesn't have any teeth. But he really just doesn't have any lips. And that doesn't have anything to do with anything. That's just something that it's popped out to me. So, in terms of, for me, I'm not going to get into it real big or bad, but this was proposed in 2000. He came into power in 2000, September 11th, 2001. And we invaded Iraq really fast and Afghanistan really fast. And those were two countries that didn't have anything to do with 9/11. And I think those were just the two easiest countries to take down and the two easiest countries to stick a narrative with in terms of Saddam Hussein and our private former involvement in the Persian Gulf in the early 90s. I think all of it has always been about oil and resources. So, brief history on Syria. The next bit of information to know, and I'm just going to give you the down and dirty facts on this, but it's also really important to know, is the petrodollar and what the petrodollar means. So in the 1970s, Nixon took us off the gold standard and put us on the petrodollar. And we convinced Saudi Arabia and then OPEC got behind it. And so all oil is priced at US currency. So as a result of that, and with all the oil in the world, and I'm betting the reason we don't want to get off oil, and I'm betting the reason why the oil companies are so determined to keep us on oil is because we are the dominant currency as a result. So again, petrodollar, Nixon, Saudi Arabia joined Nixon, and then along with OPEC, changed us from the gold standard to the petrodollar. So our US currency is backed by oil, making us the dominant currency. So in recent years, there's been some what the fuckish about that. And some people have said, hey, maybe we should, you know, not have it be the US dollar. And so some people want us to, some governments, some other, you know, countries, think maybe we should switch it to the Chinese yen. And I am curious as to if that is what this whole nonsense with trade and tariffs with China has to do with. I do not know that. Just something that I've wondered. There is also some talk and about making petrodollar cryptocurrency, so like Bitcoin. That is just new talk in terms of what's getting out to the public, but I wouldn't be surprised if it moves to that. So in terms of why we can't get off oil, quote, can't get off oil, it's because they don't want to. There's too much money involved in it. And money in terms of money for the oil companies, money for the corporations, money for people in those corporations working in oil, but also the war machine. There's so much money in war, and there's so much money in taking over these countries. And we are helping Saudi Arabia bomb Yemen at the same time we have our soldiers in Yemen or in Syria. It's all bullshit. It's all fake. It makes no sense. Okay, so down and dirty facts on Syria and the pipeline and what that is about. Obviously, much bigger story, much more detailed, but in terms of just getting into the weeds a little bit, that's what we're doing. Okay, so let's go to this week's headlines. And all of this week's headlines are from Democracy Now. Oh, and by this week's, I mean over the past couple weeks. And all of them are going to be from Democracy Now. Okay. On March 30th, the headline was, Trump says to pull troops out of Syria, quote, like very soon. The Pentagon said today that two members of the U.S.-led coalition fighting in Syria were killed and another five wounded after they set off an improvised explosive device. A spokesperson declined to identify the nationalities of the dead and wounded. The report came a day after President Trump told a campaign rally in Ohio that the U.S. was preparing to pull out of Syria. Trump, quote, we're knocking the hell out of ISIS. We'll be coming out of Syria, like, very soon. Let the other people take care of it now. Very soon. Very soon we're coming out. We're going to have 100% of the caliphate, as they call it, sometimes referred to as land. We're taking it all back quickly, quickly. We're going to be coming out of there real soon. Going to get back to a country where we belong, where we want to be. End quote. It's so hard to read his quotes. And I can't imagine trying to do dictation for him. Anyway, continuing on with the article. Earlier this month, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, now former Secretary of State, announced U.S. troops will remain indefinitely in Syria. Trump's comments Thursday appeared to catch administration officials by surprise. This is State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert being questioned Thursday by reporter Matt Lee of the Associated Press. Lee, quote, so you're not aware of any policy determination to pull the U.S. out of Syria? Heather, I am not. No. No. Lee, Okay, so the president is just speaking off the cuff and making up policy as he goes along without telling any, Heather, I don't know, I'd have to refer you back to the White House, end quote. So I firmly believe that no president ever has 100% of the information, nor does he have 100% control over any policy. Again, because they're only in there for 4 or 8 years, best case scenario. It's too dangerous to let them know all the information. And I also think that so many policies go so far back. So for instance, what I just told you about Syria, it goes back to 2000. So that was Clinton, W, Obama, and now Trump. So that would be 4 presidents. And I don't know how much Clinton was involved. But again, in terms of years and what was going on, there's no way under 4 administrations that anybody really has 100% say in terms of what's going on. And the fact that Trump just off the cuff says shit, I just think, yeah, this just reaffirms that the president has no control, because he's like, no, we're just going to get out like really soon, like very, very soon. And I like how he just threw in the caliphate, as they call it, sometimes referred to as land, because I just really feel like that was what was in his policy briefing. And so he was like, oh, that's something that I know. Anyway, he's like, no, we're going to get out. And then let's see what happens from there. So that was on March 30th. So then let's go to April 5th. Again, Democracy Now. Trump backs off plan to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria as general says, quote, hard part is still ahead. Is it? Is the hard part still ahead? Well, let's find out. Okay. President Trump has backed off his plan to soon withdraw U.S. troops from Syria. On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the administration would not put an, quote, arbitrary timeline, end quote, on withdrawal. Earlier this week, General Joseph Votel, V-O-T-E-L, the head of U.S. Central Command, said, quote, the hard part, I think, is in front of us, end quote. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports U.S. forces have been spotted setting up frontline positions outside the strategic northern town of Manbiji, M-A-N-B-I-J, where U.S.-backed Kurdish-led forces are facing off against Turkish-backed Syrian fighters. So March 30th to April 5th, let's just make that easy and call it a week. Oh, then on April 9th, let's see, what happens on April 9th? Israel bombs Syrian base, 60 killed in alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma. So from that article, the UN Security Council is meeting today to discuss the crisis in Syria, including a deadly alleged chemical weapons attack over the weekend that killed dozens of people. Earlier this morning, 2 Israeli F-15 warplanes have reportedly bombed a Syrian airbase used by Iranian forces. There are reports 14 died in the strikes, including Iranian nationals. Israel is said to have launched the raid from Lebanon's airspace. Their Israeli bombing came after a suspected chemical weapons attack killed at least 60 people in the Syrian town of Douma, the last rebel-held town in eastern Ghouta. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I say Ghouta. It's G-H-O-U-T-A. The Syrian opposition blamed the Assad government for carrying out the attack on Saturday, but Syria denied having any role. The chemical attack came one day after Syrian forces launched an air and ground assault on Douma. While international officials are still investigating what happened, Trump took to Twitter to directly accuse Putin of playing a role. He wrote, quote, President Putin, Russia, and Iran are responsible for backing Animal Assad, end quote. He went on to warn there would be, quote, a big price. And then he does an ellipsis to pay, end quote. This all comes as today marks John Bolton's first day as President Trump's national security advisor. I don't think that's a coincidence. I don't think it's a coincidence at all that Trump says, no, we're going to get out of Syria. And then Bolton is our national security advisor. No. And that Pompeo is, you know, sure, he was being grilled in terms of his Senate hearing to become Secretary of State, but I'm sure he will be passed through with flying colors. I don't think this is a coincidence at all. So the next day, so that last headline was April 9th. This one is April 10th. Trump threatens to respond forcefully to alleged chemical weapons attack in Syria. President Trump has threatened to forcefully President Trump has threatened a forceful response to this weekend's alleged chemical gas attack in Syria that killed at least 40 people and injured as many as 1,000 in the rebel-held town of Douma outside the capital, Damascus. President Trump, quote, "We're making a decision as to what we do with respect to the horrible attack that was made near Damascus, and it will be met, and it will be met forcefully. And when, I will not say, because I don't like talking about timing, but we're developing the greatest force that we've ever had," end quote. Washington has blamed the Assad government for the chemical attack, but Russia claims there's no evidence an attack even took place. And in this picture is Trump being Trump. And then we have John Bolton, and then we have Mike Pence, you know, with his hands crossed, looking very concerned. Okay, so that was on the 10th. On the 11th, the headline, "Get ready, Russia. Trump threatens to strike Syria after alleged chemical attack." The United Nations Security Council has failed to pass two resolutions to investigate the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma. Russia first blocked a U.S.-introduced resolution to set up an independent commission to investigate the alleged attack, which killed at least 40 people in the rebel-held suburb of Damascus. Russia then introduced its own resolution to investigate the alleged attack, which was blocked by the U.S. and other countries. The World Health Organization is demanding, quote, "unhindered access," end quote, to Douma to investigate the claims that at least 500 people were infected by the alleged chemical attack. The Syrian government is blocking anyone from entering the area. President Trump has blamed the Syrian government and its ally, Russia, for the alleged attack and has threatened military action. The Syrian government has denied responsibility for the attack. An independent investigation has not been conducted. On Tuesday, Trump canceled a planned trip to Latin America, saying he would stay in the U.S. to oversee the response to the alleged weapons attack. This morning, he tweeted, quote, "Russia vows to shoot down any and all missiles fired at Syria. Get ready, Russia, because they will be coming, nice and new and smart. You shouldn't be partners with a gas-killing animal who kills its people and enjoys it," end quote. This morning, Europe's Air Traffic Control Agency warned planes flying into the Eastern Mediterranean of a possible impending attack on Syria. Bullshit. I'm going to go back and read a few of these sentences. The WHO, the World Health Organization, is demanding unhindered access to Douma to investigate the claims that at least 500 people were affected by the alleged chemical attack. The Syrian government is blocking anyone from entering the area. Syria is saying, fuck off, World Health Organization, you're not coming into my country. Trump blamed the Syrian government along with Russia. Russia is Syria's ally. The Syrian government has denied responsibility for the attack, and an independent investigation has not been conducted. And I read somewhere, I thought it was in these headlines, but obviously not. I read somewhere that someone is asking the U.S. to do an independent investigation, and the U.S. is like, no. And then Syria asked for an independent investigation to be done, and they're like, no. So, I mean, come on. Honest, what I think it's a false flag. I think that if there was an attack of chemical weapons, I think the U.S. is probably behind it. And that if you want to say that the rebels or jihadists or terrorists, whatever word you want to put with them, if they actually conducted the chemical attack, like if a chemical attack actually happened, I think the U.S. allowed it to happen. And I think the U.S. probably, possibly, most likely gave them the money, gave them the chemicals for this to happen. And I think that happened this past fall, or there's so much shit that happens. I don't remember when it was, but I think it was this past fall when that chemical attack happened and we did the airstrikes from the Navy ships. I think that was a false flag. You know, that whole bullshit when, you know, these rockets red glare and we were like, he's really presidential. That, I think it was a false flag operation. I think back in 2013 during that chemical attack, when Obama wanted to go in there, and we were like, no, the American public isn't for it. When he asked Congress to go in and Congress refused, I think it's all bullshit. I think this is all false flag bullshit. And here's the reason why. So the reason why I think it's all bullshit is because, and I'm going to come at you with five different points. So Roland Dumas, D-U-M-A-S, is the former foreign minister of France, and he stated that he was made aware of the violence in Syria in 2009, which is 2 years before it started. So 2 years before it even started, this guy is saying that he knew what was going to be coming. So, quote, I'm going to tell you something, Dumas said on a French station, LCP, quote, I was in England 2 years before the violence in Syria on other business. I met with top British officials who confessed to me that they were preparing something in Syria. This was in Britain, not in America. Britain was organizing an invasion of rebels in Syria. They even asked me, although I was no longer Minister for Foreign Affairs, if I would like to participate. Naturally, I refused. I said, I'm French. That doesn't interest me. This opposition goes way back. It was prepared, preconceived, and planned. End quote. So he's saying he was made aware of this in 2009, which is 2 years before all the violence started. The second reason is from December 13th, 2006. And this is a cable published by WikiLeaks. And it reveals how 5 years prior to the beginning of the violence, the U.S. government was seeking out weaknesses of the Assad government, which could be exploited to undermine it. So William Roebuck, an official at the U.S. embassy in Damascus, said the following. So, quote, So this was published by WikiLeaks, and it was revealed 5 years prior to the beginning of the violence. So this is from 2006. And this William Roebuck, an official at the U.S. embassy in Damascus, said this in his summary of the cable. We believe Bashar, so Assad's, weakness are in how he chooses to react to looming issues, both perceived and real, such as the conflict between economic reform steps, however limited, and entrenched corrupt forces. The Kurdish question and the potential threat to the regime from the increasing presence of transistine Islamist extremists, this cable summarizes our assessment of these vulnerabilities and suggests that there may be actions, statements, and signals that the U.S. government can send that will improve the likelihood of such opportunities arising, end quote. That goes into another article from 2015 where the U.S. was planning to provoke an overreaction from Assad against the various oppositions in regards to Syria in terms of how he overreacted to demonstrations and protests. And when you hear things about Syria, what you hear is how Assad hates the protests and how he overreacts and how he sends in, you know, the troops and the rebels and there's always fighting and everything. When it comes to protests and they're a peaceful protest and all of a sudden they turn violent, a lot of times that is an operative. The person starting the violence could be a CIA operative. It could be a government official from a Syrian government official. There's somebody that will turn it violent to make it look bad in terms of the media and public outcry, because look how irrational these people are. And, you know, you're trying to get your point across that you turn to violence and that's not going to be respected and no one respects the violence, a riot. And if you want to protest, that's fine, but you know, you don't need to be violent about it. When in reality, it wasn't the protesters that turned violent. It was a paid operative, a informant, something to that effect, that purposefully and specifically turns it violent to discredit it and then make that the narrative. So you can see this in Black Lives Matter rallies and protests. You can see this in the reaction to the election and some of the violence there. You can see that in any country where there's protests and then it suddenly turns violent. You can see it I will just make it really basic. With the DNC, the primary in Nevada, where there was outcry and they were angry. And then what just kept being said over and over again by the media and what was that, you know, chairs were being thrown and people were yelling and people were in each other's faces. Did you see any of that? You heard it, but did you see it? And that's why, if there's ever a protest or if there's ever anything going on, I want to watch it live. I don't want to watch clips of it, because you see the same clips over and over and over again. You never see anything other than that soundbite. And more to the point is that it's edited. And what you hear being what caused something versus the reality of what actually caused something, two totally different things. And what I've really come to know in terms of like images and what we see to specific events is, when you watch a documentary about the Vietnam War or a TV show or something about the Vietnam War, you see the same images over and over and over again. You never see any, you see the airplanes dropping the napalm and huge blasts of fire, maybe some guys sitting around in their helmets, looking weary, maybe some soldiers going through rice paddies with their rifles above their head. Then you might see the monk setting himself on fire. The kids having been napalmed, running down the road naked. So it's the same images over and over and over again. When it comes to the Democratic Convention in Chicago in the 1960s and the violence that erupted there, it's the same images of the violence over that you see all the time. It's the same people getting hit in the head. And maybe those were all the images that were ever captured, but I doubt it. And this point really hit home again when I was watching a documentary on Martin Luther King this past weekend. It was on HBO. It was called King in the Wilderness. I'll probably speak of this again in another episode because it really struck me. And it was images that I had never, ever, ever seen when it came to Martin Luther King. And it was him after 1964, basically. It was when he started to speak out against poverty and when he started speaking out against Vietnam. But in addition to that, him doing different walks and people protesting the marches and the walks and all of the white power signs. Like there was images of little kids and adults, of course, holding white power and the swastika. I'd never seen images like that before. I've seen white people screaming at black people, and I've seen white people spitting on black people. And I've seen dogs coming after him, and I've seen the fire hoses, and I've seen black men being pushed by white people, and the black man standing back up again, and the lunch counters. I have never seen white power Nazi signs being held up by white people as black marchers walk by. And I thought that was really interesting. And I wondered how much of that had, that being shown now, has to do with the white supremacist, white Nazi rise in that. So I think it's really interesting the images that were shown over and over and over again that become part of the narrative, and that how those images formulate the narrative and formulate our ideas and our prejudices. So back to Syria and why I think this is all bullshit. Number three, General Wesley Clark's statement. And I am getting this was very nicely broken down in an article that I received today in my inbox from Caitlin Johnstone. I just recently discovered her. And I knew I was going to do the Syria podcast today, and then this showed up in my inbox, and I was like, yes! So, cite my source. So, General Wesley Clark. And if you don't know this statement, it's a very famous statement that he made on Democracy Now! In 2007. However, he came out about this statement, I believe, in 2004. But this is him giving an interview on Democracy Now! From them, and I am just going to read it. And he had a conversation with a general in 2001. So this is General Wesley Clark reciting a conversation that he had with a general in 2001 on Democracy Now! In 2007. About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. And I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me in. He said, quote, "Sir, you've got to come in and talk to me a second," end quote. I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No, no." He says, "We've made the decision we're going to war with Iraq," end quote. This was on about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq? Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, "No, no." He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail," end quote. So I come back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan, and I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." And he reached over his desk and he picked up a piece of paper and he said, "I just got this down from upstairs," meaning he got that from the Secretary of Defense's office. And he got it that day. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take over 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off with Iran," end quote. So this has been the plan all along. And we've already done Iraq. We did Afghanistan for no reason. We're really, really trying to get into Syria. We've overthrown Libya. It doesn't really seem like we're doing much with Lebanon. We're in Somalia, and we're in Somalia because of oil. Sudan, I don't really think we're doing very much with, but we're trying to get into Iran. As far as I'm concerned, we're trying to get into Iran because of the whole nuclear deal bullshit. So that be the plan. Number four, the 1986 CIA memo. So a CIA document was declassified last year, and it exposed a plot to overthrow the Syrian government by provoking sectarian tensions, and it goes all the way back to 1986. So these are just a few of the excerpts, and these are going to be all quotes. So, although we judge that fear of reprisals and organizational problems make a second Sunni challenge unlikely, an excessive government reaction to minor outbreaks of Sunni disobedience might trigger large-scale unrest. In most instances, the regime would have the resources to crush a Sunni opposition movement, but we believe widespread violence among the populace could stimulate large numbers of Sunni officers and conscripts to desert or mutiny, setting the stage for civil war, end quote. So they wanted to crush the Sunni opposition movement, and they believed that widespread violence among the populace could stimulate large numbers of Sunni officers and conscripts to leave or mutiny, and it would set the stage for civil war, which that kind of sounds like what happened. I'm going to take a drink. Next quote, we believe that a renewal of communal violence between Alawalis and Sunnis could inspire Sunnis in the military to turn against the regime. Huh. Sunni dissidence has been minimal since Assad crushed the Muslim Brotherhood in the early 1980s, but deep-seated tensions remain keeping alive the potential for minor incidents to grow into major flare-ups of communal violence. Excessive government force and quelling such disturbances might be seen by Sunnis as evidence of government vendetta against all Sunnis, precipitating even larger protests by other Sunni groups. Mistaking the new protests as a resurgence of the Muslim Brotherhood, the government would step up its use of force and launch violent attacks on a broad spectrum of Sunni community leaders, as well as on those engaged in protests. Regime efforts to restore order would founder if government violence against protesters inspired broad-based communal violence between Alawalis and Sunnis. A general campaign of Alawali violence against Sunnis might push even moderate Sunnis to join the opposition. Remnants of the Muslim Brotherhood, some returning from exile in Iraq, could provide a core of leadership for the movement. Although the regime has the resources of crush such a venture, we believe brutal attacks on Sunni civilians might prompt large numbers of Sunni officers and conscripts to desert or stage mutinies in support of dissidents, and Iraq might supply them with sufficient weapons to launch a civil war. In our view, U.S. interests would be best served by a Sunni regime controlled by business-oriented moderates. Business moderates would see a strong need for Western aid and investment to build Syria's private economy, thus opening the way for stronger ties to Western government. I'm going to read that last one more time. In our view, U.S. interests would be best served by a Sunni regime controlled by business-oriented moderates. Businesses moderators would see a strong need for Western aid and investment to build Syria's private economy, thus opening the way for stronger ties to Western government. If you destroy it, you got to rebuild it. So they're referring to Assad, but that is a declassified memo from 1986. It was a plan to overthrow a CIA plan to overthrow Syria by provoking sectarian tensions. And it's all the way back to 1986. And it was declassified. And it was so I'm going to look up Assad one more time. Yeah. Because he came into power in 2000. Okay. So, Bashar al-Assad became president in 2000, and his dad died on June 10th, 2000. So when it referred to Assad in that CIA document, it's referring to his father. to clarify. Okay, so going back to the last reason why I think this is all bullshit. So there's plenty of known coups that have happened around the world, but there are also two that were attempted in 1940 and 1950. So the CIA has been attempting to stage a coup since the 1940s. So in a 1969 interview, CIA officer Miles Copeland confirmed statements he'd made in his memoirs that the Central Intelligence Agency had attempted to overthrow the Syrian government 20 years earlier. So this is in 1969, so that would be 1949. In 1956, there was an anti-communist intervention called Operation Straggle, Straggle, followed by Operation Wappen, Wappen. And in 1957, there was a CIA/MI6 assassination plot. It's insane. So in 1956, there was the anti-communist intervention called Operation Straggle, followed by Operation Wappen, and then in 1957, there was a CIA MI6 assassination plot. So I did not click on these links earlier, but I'm going to now to find out what Operation Straggle was, and I'm going to take a drink. Oh, okay. Well, this article is extremely long. So I'm not going to do that to you. Okay, but just in looking at one of the paragraphs, Syria achieved its independence in 1945. It became a special case for Western powers with an interest in Middle East affairs, as well as an important actor in inter-Arab politics. The removal of French administration and military forces from the country left no Western power with central... Oh, that's all I get. I bet I have to pay for the rest. So that's not going to happen. Well, it might happen. Okay. And then Operation... Okay, well, is it going to... Let's go back to it. Because is it going to give me just a little bit of information? Force a ceasefire, Britain and France, Suez Canal, Egypt. While research upon the Suez crisis continues to provide useful insights into the nature of events in the Middle East and the pattern of Anglo-American relations. Okay, developments in Syria in 55 and 56. The country had a pivotal strategic and diplomatic position in the Cold War, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the battle for leadership within the Arab world. Well, all that's been fucked over and fucked up. Okay, I have to pay for the rest of the article, and I'm not going to do that right now, so... Back to what can we find out about Operation Wappen, Wappen. Okay, Operation Wappen, 1957. DCI Alan Dulles continued to file reports about the dangers of communism in Syria. The CIA planned for another coup, codenamed Operation Wappen, and organized by Kermit Roosevelt. He was the son of Theodore Roosevelt. Syrian military officers were paid off in anticipation. Of course they were. Bribes reportedly totaled $3 million, and this is in 1957, so that's a lot of money. The coup failed when some of these officers revealed the plan to the Syrian intelligence service. Good job. They turned in the CIA bribe money and identified the officers who had tendered it. Robert Moley, France. Okay, blah, 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 blah. They were deported. The U.S. State Department denied Syrian accusations of a coup attempt to ban Syrian ambassadors to the U.S. and withdrew its own ambassador from Syria. The New York Times backed the U.S. government's claim and suggested that the story had been fabricated for political purposes. Of course they did. After the coup attempt was exposed, the U.S. government and media began describing Syria as, quote, a Soviet satellite, end quote. One intelligence report suggested that the USSR had developed, quote, not more than 123 MiGs to the country. I don't know what that means. Reporter Kenneth Love later said that, quote, there were indeed not more than 123 MiGs. Again, don't know what that means. There were none. I don't know what a MiG is. In September 1957, the U.S. deployed a fleet to the Mediterranean, armed several of Syria's neighbors, and incited Turkey to deploy 50,000 troops to its border. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles suggested that the U.S. sought to invoke, quote, the Eisenhower Doctrine, end quote, of retaliating against provocation, and this intention was later confirmed in a military report. No Arab state would describe Syria as a provocateur, and these military deployments were withdrawn. Assassination plot, 1957. Explicit documents from September 1957 reveal a plot including collaboration with the British Intelligence Service, MI6, and a plot to assassinate three Syrian officials in Damascus. These targets were Abdel Hamid al-Sarraj, it's A-L-S-A-R-R-A-J, head of military intelligence. I'm not going to butcher all these names. The other guy was an army chief of staff, and then the other one was a leader of the Syrian Communist Party. All figures who had gained politically from exposure of the American plot. Details about this conspiracy were revealed by a, quote, working group report, unquote, uncovered in 2003 among the papers of British Defense Minister Duncan Sandys. And from that, once a political decision is reached to proceed with internal disturbances in Syria, CIA is prepared and MI6 will attempt to mount minor sabotage and coup demand incidents within Syria, working through contacts with individuals. The two services should consult as appropriate to avoid any overlapping or interference with each other's activities. Incidents should not be concentrated in Damascus. The operation should not be overdone, and to that extent, possible care should be taken to avoid causing key leaders of the Syrian regime to take additional personal protection measures. Okay, it goes on much further than that. I'm going to end there. So there's all that. Also, another fun fact that I learned today, other than the fact that we just keep repeating history over and over and over fucking over again, is that did you know that Tony Blair tried to give Bashir al-Assad a honorary knighthood in 2002? I didn't either. But then, and the hopes there was to create like a Western alliance, but Assad refused, and then that narrative quickly changed to Assad had an addiction to gassing children. So it's the fucking narrative that we're fed, and you have to look through the bullshit, and you need to go back and look at history. And I know it's dirty and it's messy and it's ugly and it's depressing. But with all of our resources right now, and net neutrality does not go into effect until April 24th. And I really hope that you're in a state that's going to fight it. And several states have passed bills and their state is now not going to be part of net neutrality. You have all of the access to all of the information, and it doesn't take a deep dive. And if it's just listening to podcasts like this, and there's many, many others where we will dissect the information for you, then please, please share. Please listen. Please share. I am happy to do the deep dive for you. I would love for this to be my job. I would love to do nothing but go down the rabbit holes and then regurgitate it to the masses. Because that's what I do in my spare time. So if I could get paid to do it, all the better. It would be all the better. I firmly believe this is a false flag operation. It's nothing but bullshit. It's been in the works since 2000. This just showed us that it's been in the works since the 1950s. We want those resources. Our U.S. currency is backed by oil. Money, power, influence. Money, power, influence. It's what it's all about. It's what it's always all about. Resources. If a country doesn't have anything we want, we will leave them alone. There are plenty of humanitarian crises going on around the world. There are plenty of dictators doing horrible things to their people. There are plenty of countries with starving children. There are plenty of countries being decimated by their dictators. There are plenty of countries without food, water, sanitation. Yemen being a big one. We don't give a fuck. We don't care. We don't care. And a lot of times we're the ones causing the humanitarian crisis. Be skeptical. Listen to what the narrative is. Why has Russia suddenly become the bad guy? Why are we provoking the Russian bear? Because Russia is aligned with Syria. Syria doesn't want a goddamn pipeline going through its country. Syria wants to keep the resources for their own people. And you can say, well, yeah, but the gas attack. Why is a gas attack worse than a bullet? Why is a gas attack worse than a drone strike? Why is a gas attack worse than being in the bottom floor of a building that was just demolished by a missile? Well, you can say it's a much more painful way to die. Is it more painful than being demolished by a concrete building falling on you? Is it more horrific than walking down the street and seeing your mom's head be blown off? I mean, come on. And the U.S. has done plenty of shit, and we are continuing to do plenty of shit. One shouldn't be worse than the other. We're just as guilty. It's about oil. It all comes down to oil, money, power, and influence. We must be the world police. We have to justify why our military budget just went up by $80 billion. Billion with a B. It all has to be justified. The thing with a budget is that you have to use all that money, or else why am I increasing your budget the following year? It's got to be justified. If you asked for $100 for your budget, but you only spent $25 this year, and next year you're asking for $250, well, why? Why am I giving you an extra $150? I need to know a reason, especially since you didn't spend even half of last year's budget, because we have to protect ourselves. We have to protect our interests. We have to protect our interests. What are our interests? Glad you asked. Oil. And that oil being backed by the petrodollar. And the petrodollar is backed by U.S. currency. And the U.S. dollar, because of the petrodollar, is the dominant currency of the world. Yep. Nonsense and bullshit. So, I know this seemed long, but I know we got through it. Okay, we're going to pretend that I didn't, and I really hope I didn't. So I'm going to say, once again, thank you for listening. I do have some interviews lined up. I have 3 interviews lined up over the next couple weeks, and I'm very excited about that. One, I have no idea what I'm going to talk about with any 3 of my guests. Which I like. I don't want to know beforehand what we're going to discuss, because then it doesn't feel natural. It doesn't feel organic. It feels more rehearsed. I swear to you, when Adam is on the podcast, I live with him. I know that I can just throw a few topics out and I know what's going to catch, but they are not pre-planned. So if you would like to be a guest on my podcast, I would love to have you. Please get a hold of me. Send me a private message. Leave a comment on this podcast. I will be in touch. And we can set something up. Aside from that, please follow my podcast, because I really want to get some of the people running for office on the podcast. And I can't do that if I don't have followers and I don't have listeners. So please follow the podcast. Please encourage others to follow this podcast. Please like us on Facebook. Just, you know, do all of the things. Do all the things that you know that you need to do that I'm going to ask you to do. Please do all of them. And then I will say, thank you for listening. Remember to share the love, not the hate. Thank you. Love you. Bye.